Yet I'm really looking forward to the show. It's sort of a theme here, I guess, really. If we go from the last guest here with the discussion about vampires, witches, and pagans, the vampire that's running for the governor in Minnesota, which I'm sure you'll hear more about coming up on Coast to Coast AM. And by the way, too, I didn't want to curtail that conversation, but we were just coming up to the end of the hour, so we'll try to have him back sometime. Or I could also suggest to Jonathan the Impaler, if he's listening too. And you wouldn't think he'd have to make the suggestion, him being a vampire and all, but he needs to master the art of the sound bite, just to keep the answers a little shorter, because some of what I wanted to get to, we didn't have time for, but we will, I'm sure, sometime in the future. And then on to Tracy Twyman. You remember her. And if you've never heard her talk before on Coast to Coast, then you will never forget her after tonight. Love this book. What if our money were magic? Now, just start there for a second. As a premise, it just sounds ridiculous. Of course, it's not magic. It's tied into our capitalistic system. Well, what if our capitalistic system were based on magic? What does that mean exactly? Well, what is the greatest example of magic of all time? And I don't mean the sort of Las Vegas style magic or the sleight of hand type magic, but what was the greatest pursuit of magicians down through the centuries? It was turning nothing into something. It was turning lead into gold. It was alchemy. And that was always what the magicians were trying to do: take nothing, take worthlessness, and turn it into something of value. I mean, if it's true somehow that that's what our economy is based on, if it's true that that's what our paper money represents, then it would seem as though it would have to be, well, it'd have to be covered in magical symbols. Well, what if our money served less like currency and more like an amulet? Typically an amulet is an article made of metal or paper containing magical symbols. What if that were true? Then it would have to be that our dollar bills or all of our currency would have to be imbued with a kind of special power that gave the bearer protection against bad things or empowered them to do good. Well, that's just what Tracy Twyman believes is actually happening and has always been happening and was the intent of many of our founding fathers. Paper money, gold coins as amulets of power. Solomon's treasure. The magic and mystery of America's money, next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. It's like a reunion night for me on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, Tracy.
Hello, Ian. Nice to talk to you again. It's been a while.
I know it has, and pardon me for asking, but how's that Boyd guy? Where's he ended up these days? He was your partner for a while there, wasn't
Yeah, for a while. Honestly, we haven't worked together for a few years now, so I don't really know what's going on with him
Well, I
right
think
now.
the last time you were on with him, seems to me.
Yeah,
Does
that's
that
true.
sound right?
Yes, but I've been working on my own now for a few years.
And doing great.
Thanks.
This is a really good book.
Oh, I'm glad you like it.
I mean, your attention to detail is just, it's, you don't fudge anything that I've come across so far in this book, which
Wow.
I think that's really good, 'cause I think some people would be happy to just sort of generalize something, and you're very specific, and you back up everything you claim, and I respect that tons.
Well, thanks a lot.
I think people will really enjoy the book, just if nothing else for that reason. And it's been out, what, for about a year?
No, it just came out
No,
about a
really?
month ago, yeah.
Oh, terrific. Well, see, I thought I was just catching up. think this is great. Solomon's Treasure, The Magic and Mystery of America's Money. And so let's back up a little bit and say, is the magazine still going?
No, there's no longer any Dagobert's Revenge magazine, although there's still some back issues that people can get if they want.
Okay. And from now on, it's just going to be books?
Yeah, basically. I have a really long, complicated ideas that I need more space to be able to explain them. And I apologize if, like your previous guest, I haven't mastered the art of the soundbite. You'll have to forgive me.
No, you know what? I love what you've written here. I haven't finished it, but I'm going to finish this whole thing.
Great.
Although I'm deeply into it. And we'll get to the conversation of your central claim here coming up in a few minutes. But let's start with a discussion of money by talking about what money had been like in Europe leading up to the United States, because I think that's an interesting kind of background we need to have. And you talk about a little bit about how money represented the power of the king or the queen or whoever it was that was issuing the currency.
Well, yeah, certainly before the United States, everything basically was a monarchy in Europe and throughout the rest of the world, too. And the monarchs would always have their own image stamped on the coin. And the term coin of the realm kind of illustrates this idea. The realm comes from the word reality. The reality comes from king, real, royalty, and it means basically the king declares what's real. And and the idea of the coin of the realm, the coin, it's like it represents the king's ability to create reality. And
the
stamp his image on that coin means that he can say, I say that this money means something.
Right. And it also at the same time reminded the bearer of where the power came from or where the treasury was. There's the king's face was on it. It was at all times an important reminder that there's somebody very important who is allowing you to do this. And here's his picture and name.
Yes.
Right.
And then when the United States came around, when we started having the revolution and we're planning having an independent nation here, it was going to be a democratic country without a king. And so that was one of the issues they faced was what to put on the money. We can't put an image of a king. And so they...
No, you're going too fast. Slow down. Okay. We don't need to go there yet.
All right.
Because there's too many other interesting things for background, I think, before we get there. But talk about what some of the coins of the realm were that were popular before the United States, some of which were going around the world. They became almost talismans in a way of they were so that the coins themselves were valuable and they were international forms of currency even before the dollar.
That's true. And in fact, the dollar itself, there's the American dollar, but the term dollar has been used for hundreds of years before that. There was this one dollar. Well, they were called thalers, I guess you would pronounce it.
How do you pronounce it? I'm sorry. Pronounced how?
Thalers.
Thalers?
T-H. Yeah.
Right.
And it's a German term. And there was this one thaler called the Mary Teresa thaler. And it had the image of that queen on it. And it became, she was a loved queen. And the coin became kind of synonymous with money itself at a certain point. It became so popular throughout Europe and even other places in the world that other countries would copy it. And they kept minting it up until the 1800s, actually.
Well, even in some forms, didn't they even continue after World War II?
Yes, that's right. That's
I mean, so, and this is from a queen. What year did the Maria Theresa live? It's in your book if I can find it. What's that?
1600s, maybe?
Yeah. I mean, so here's somebody, but that's just how powerful that image was. That image said stability. The image said value. And people associated the image of that coin as something of value so that anytime a government was trying to establish itself as issuing something of value, they would stamp her face on it because that's how people had become acculturated. Is that
right?
Yeah,
some people wouldn't even accept anything else. They didn't when their government issued other coins, they didn't believe them. So they demanded that they meant this particular one.
I think that's a fascinating idea. I mean, the same thing's true with the pieces of eight, or with the Spanish money that was used in the United States even after the Revolution.
Right. Yeah, the reals.
The reals, that they were perceived as having value, and so other currency didn't count. But then you go back to the thing you started with about the Scottish thalers, or what it becomes dollars, and that idea was that they didn't want to use even the same word as the British were using. It was a thumb in the eye to the British to not use the word pound for Scottish money.
Yeah, that's what. And in fact, a lot of the people who were involved in organizing the revolution were Scottish immigrants. And so this was a way of showing that they were more true to their Scottish heritage than to their British heritage, that we're doing something different. And so, yeah, they didn't want to have the pound. They decided to have the dollar instead.
So it's the politics of money were going on even perhaps before people were articulating it as such. It was happening just sort of organically, what people associated with value just kind of grew on its own. So that brings us back to a discussion about magic. Talk a little while about magic. What is magic in this sense that we're talking about in the book?
Well, it's just basically the idea of making something happen at will, affecting change on reality. And, you know, of course, you can change something with your hand by touching it, or you can do so at a distance, and that's usually what's considered magical. Any sort of a alteration of reality that doesn't have a traceable cause to it,
right,
in reality.
Now, that's interesting, because then it's the domination over cause and effect, that you can affect something without a proper cause, just because of your presence or because of the words you say. You can make something happen. It's almost let there be light, and you could make light out of nothing.
Well, yeah, exactly.
And this is what was driving the magicians of the Middle Ages. They were trying to find a way to turn lead into gold.
Yeah, and in many of the descriptions of the alchemical operations that they attempted, they talk about this universal agent, or they call it the Azoth, A-Z-O-T-H. This, and they never really describe what it is, but this necessary thing that an alchemist has to have in order to make the transformation. And it's this totally ephemeral thing that can transform anything into anything else, they say. And if you read into the alchemical text, you get the feeling that they're talking about faith or the power of magic.
Well, and I think this is interesting, too. It's kind of a different take. I mean, one, we think of magic, we might think of Bewitched, right? Right? One twinkle of the nose and suddenly somebody is standing there in a toga and sandals. And I used to ask myself in my head, where did the toga and sandals come from, supposedly? You know, when suddenly Darren was blinked into the costume of Napoleon or something, did that come from some place? And then she was transporting it there in the blink of an eye? Or, you know, how is that happening? Or the other way you can look at magic is that you just take it on faith that something has happened, that you sort of surrender some of your disbelief, some of your own will, if you will, and you sort of surrender it to the magician.
Yeah, well, I think that's definitely how a lot of magic has worked anyway, both stage magic and, you know, real magic. It's like if everyone believes that the magician has succeeded in transforming something or changing something, then it's real. As long as everyone agrees on it, then it's true.
Well, isn't that the key part, is everybody agreeing? Because that'll bring us right back to this discussion of money.
Yeah.
Everybody's got to agree. But all right, so that's magic. Now, the Masons, if I think about magic, I don't always think about Freemasons and magic. Can you talk about that connection with Freemasons and the occult?
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, it's like, a lot of people don't think of Freemasons as magicians, but if you start reading their rituals and literature about the rituals, the meaning behind it, especially if you're like me at all familiar with the occult, it's very obvious that that is what they're doing. That it's like they're doing magic rituals in a group and they've been codified over the years in such a way that they don't seem like magical rituals, but that's definitely what they're doing. They're doing the same sorts of rituals that people have always been doing. And a good book to read about this, and I wouldn't suggest reading the whole thing, but there's this huge book called Morals and Dogma by Albert Pike. He goes through all the rituals of the 33 degrees in the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry.
Sure.
And he describes all the rituals, including the 32nd degree, which is all about alchemy. And I've used his writings about the 32nd degree as a resource about alchemy numerous times because he lays it all out, explains it exactly. And, I mean, you definitely get the idea from reading this book that the secret you learn when you get to the 32nd degree of Freemasonry is about how to do alchemy.
And if the founding fathers were 33 degree Masons, then they were very familiar with this idea of taking something that was worthless and turning it into valuable amulets, turning it into something of power, turning it into lead into gold, if you will.
Definitely. And, you know, if you think about it, they kind of did that with the United States. You know, I mean, not to say that this landmass was not valuable, but there was no government here. And they came and they transformed it into something that no one could have ever imagined. And it didn't happen overnight. But definitely, when you look at what they've done with the monetary system of the United States, you can tell that they definitely understood these principles.
Well, and actually, I think that is a really good point you make about the United States, that if you looked at it when it was just the New World, it was amorphous. It was a series of colonies, and it was almost on the importation of Freemasonry and of many of the belief systems, the universalists that were within Freemasonry, did it become more than just that, but it became an experiment for a new type of society, one which was built on, as many people would argue, built on Masonic principles more than Christian principles.
Definitely. And, you know, I guess I take that almost as a given. I forget that some people don't know about that. You know, it's like so clear to me that Freemasons not only were a lot of the people who signed the Declaration of Independence Freemasons, but the Washington, D.C. is laid out according to a Masonic plan. And you can see also the symbols on the money, and just the concept of the United States is a Masonic concept. The idea of a democratic government, even though they did it in Greece, but the concept really was formulated into what we would think of it at today by Freemasons during the Enlightenment era of philosophy. Formulating these ideas that you could have a free democratic society, and even the word free is, they didn't come up with it, but it's basically a Masonic idea that a man can be free, that he doesn't owe his life to the king. He can go and earn a living on his own as a free man without having to, you know.
The power isn't borrowed from somebody else.
Exactly.
But it's imbued.
Man.
All right. We'll pick up the conversation here because we're just getting started. We're laying the foundation blocks for the book Solomon's Treasure by talking about Freemasons and the occult, magic, amulets, and money, how this all intersects, coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. You know, I'm going to grab Tracy Twyman here for a quick minute and just again tell her how much I enjoyed the book Solomon's Treasure. We'll talk more about her beliefs in the magic and mystery of America's money. And I'll tell people again, it'd be handy to have a dollar bill handy and a piece of paper and something to write with, because we're going to go over some stuff here that I think people are going to want to be able to draw for themselves and test on here in just a moment. Hey Tracy.
Yes.
Tell everybody your background on this, and because you mentioned your familiarity with the occult, so just so we talk about your ethos in this subject.
Okay, well, I have been studying occultism, Freemasonry, and secret societies for about 10 years now, and I used to publish a magazine called Dagobert's Revenge about it, and then I wrote a book last year called The Merovingian Mythos, and it's about similar subject matter to the Da Vinci Code, if your listeners are familiar with that. But basically, you know, I've been studying this stuff for so long, I've become very comfortable with the idea that secret societies are influential and have influenced history, and even to a certain extent now. And when you look at history from that perspective, things start to snap into place.
Yeah.
It makes sense why people do the things that they do.
A lot of blanks get filled in.
Definitely.
Now, whether they're right, we can't quite always know, because, of course, that's the nature of a secret society. But looking at the evidence, for example, the dollar bill coming up, it's hard to imagine that this was all coincidence, and that it seems like so much of what we do have, as you mentioned, you know, like Washington, D.C. and the layouts and the signs of the Zodiac and all these important places, that occultism existed at a very subtle level, perhaps under the radar, maybe even of proper society, but that it's always been there.
Yeah. And, you know, it really wasn't so much of a secret, but it's just that I don't think it meant much to people. You know, it's like there wasn't TV and newspapers to inform everybody of the secret society that George Washington was a member of. And so not every farmer or regular person out there knew about it, but definitely people who were in government and in influential positions knew about these secret societies. And, you know, either you're a member and you're in, or you're outside of it and then you resent them and you wish you were a member.
Or you didn't even notice, as in the case of so much of the symbolism of some of these secret societies, is that it can fairly easily blend into the scenery. It doesn't necessarily jump out at you that you're looking at something which it has a powerful symbolic connotation for a certain person.
Yeah, I mean, I got to admit that before I knew about Freemasonry and the symbols on the dollar bill, I looked at that dollar every day of my whole life and never thought about it.
Well, or even the Washington Monument, you know, and other things which we're so used to seeing that we forget that somewhere, somehow, somebody thought of that, and they used that as an intentional symbol for George Washington. And we'll get back to that coming up. And the dollar bill and everything. And by the way, you're doing, you know, terrific. So you don't have to worry about the sound bite.
Okay, good.
You know, because you're not running for office. You're not running for office, are you?
No, not at all.
Okay. All right. And if you talk in sound bites in this show, it should be a very long show, because I'll have to ask a million questions.
Yeah.
If you can answer very short questions. All right, so we'll come right back. Then we'll pick it up right here. The combination all will start coming together, and you'll see it in your own hand. And then this very powerful idea of money as magic. You may even be thinking to yourself, oh, I totally see where this is going. I don't know if you do yet. Coming up next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. All right, so we're talking about magic and money, Tracy Twyman, and you can link up to her through coasttocoastam.com. Tracy, we have three threads going here. We'll tie them all together coming up. But let's just recap again. We're talking about how the power of money against the backdrop of Europe, that the power was all about who issued the money, which was the king or the queen. And the images on the coin were intended to remind you of that powerful person to whom you owed your existence. Some cases, some coins superseded that, and the image itself of stability and trust became bigger than the queen herself, in the case of the Maria Theresa coin, which became such a powerful symbol that it was used by governments who had no idea who she was, because just somehow the people knew that that coin was trustworthy, it had value, and so that symbol of her face was used long after it had any of its original meaning, but just took on a meaning of its own. And then we talked about the Freemasons and their dabbling with the occult and we're kind of tying this all together here in the United States. What do we know about the founding fathers? I mean, know for sure about the founding fathers and occultism.
Well, we know that they were Freemasons, or a lot of them were. And even the ones that weren't members of the Brotherhood were members of other groups that were somewhat similar, or certainly they were familiar with the ideas and the philosophy. And we know that they put Masonic symbols on government things everywhere. That shows that not only were they members of a club, but they were actively trying to create a Masonic Republic here in the United States.
Yeah, the shift comes in the American history between colonies underneath the British, by and large, although there were other European powers involved. But underneath the British, the shift comes from being colonies to having an identity of its own. And that kind of comes with the influx of Masonic philosophy, you believe?
Definitely.
Okay. And so as many of the founding fathers were either moved here or grew up here within Masonry, they began to focus on these new ideas that were coming out of radical Europe. It wasn't, you know, proper Europe in one sense. It was radical Europe about a man's right for happiness and property.
Yeah, yeah. The original draft of the Declaration of Independence, before it was finalized, said that we have a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of property. And property was later replaced with the word happiness, which I guess they thought was more general. But originally, they had this understanding that property was happiness. You know,
But that meant power too. It meant real estate as power. It was something real, and in that way, you had something. You owned something.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't think that was really formally recognized in the old world, you know, that at any time the king could come and declare your property his. And, you know, no one really had anything except by the pleasure of the king, you know?
Right. And or in even severer times when you were forced to be whatever your father was by royal decree.
Yes, yes. And, you know, before the capitalist economies started to form in the 1700s onward. There was feudal, well, I guess it started a little bit earlier than that, but the previous economic system was feudalism, in which you had to, you were born on a manor, and you basically everything that you needed in life was produced on the manor. You lived there, you died there, and then your son grew up and did the same thing, and no one ever expected anything different. And that was, in a feudalist economy, there was basically no one was using money except some of the nobles were using it. You know, some of the government was using it, but nobody really needed money. They just bartered for everything.
But with money gave them the ability to move upward in their social structure, that you, the more money you got, the more power you got. And that was an early idea, as you mentioned, when capitalism got introduced. Talk a little bit about capitalism as you see it from the perspective of an occultist.
Well, in a capitalist economy, you can invest money in a project, or you can loan it to someone, and you get back an exponential return. The money grows. You don't just, you know, trade wheat for something else. You know, it actually increases in value. You know, a dollar becomes several dollars. And that's something that really wasn't possible prior to capitalism.
And capitalism, in that sense, takes a small something and turns it into a larger something. So again, we're coming back to this idea a little bit of growing something, much like the alchemists hoped to do. And so capitalism, even in its very early form, was kind of a threat to the power structure of the feudalistic societies, which depended on people to being willing to be staying in their place for the rest of their lives and the lives of their children. And so capitalism came along, and it offered this very powerful idea that said you could do better, and you can make something happen entirely on your own effort.
Yeah, and it sort of came about without, you know, the governments formally decreeing, now we have capitalism. It's just that Well, actually, a lot of it had to do with colonizing the New World. When the Spaniards came here, they found all this gold and silver and exported it over to Europe, and it quickly left the Spanish economy and went into the Dutch and English economies. And all of a sudden, they had this flood of money that they had never had before. And even though it caused inflation, what it also caused, the money spread around and people started trading it. People started investing it in things. And, you know, without the kings even being aware of what's going on, all of a sudden the traders and the merchants are the ones that have the power because they can pay someone to do what they want. And the king, you know, he can, kings and nobles can still exert their influence, but they were very much threatened by people who had money.
And so in a way, again, capitalism becomes a form of magic. You have to suspend your disbelief in a way, and you have to say, all right, here's five of us. We're all going to give money to Tracy. Tracy's going to take this money, and she's going to invest it in the manufacture of this machine that she has made. And this machine, when it turns a profit, will return money to us from the money that we gave her. And even though we gave money to her out of nothing, we will get something back for it. And it'll become as a result of your effort and your ingenuity, and that becomes the basis of capitalism. It requires a level of faith that something is going to happen from when you hand over your money to somebody else.
Yeah, and it's power to transform reality, really, how you can almost get anything you want if you have enough money for it. Was really threatening to the powers that existed. That's the power that they had before. They could just declare something, and it was law. It was truth. And here's money, and now it, all of a sudden it has the same power.
I think a good example of that is this guy who's introduced this new car line. Did you hear about this in Detroit? He's a Chinese businessman. He was born the son of a peasant in China. He was good at repairing machines. He repaired washing machines, got some capital, started building washing machines, got some capital. Now he's one of China's biggest manufacturer of automobiles and has now begun to export his automobiles to the United States. They're called Geelys. And I just think that's very, and I think Geely even itself has a name meaning luck or associated with luck. But I think that's a very interesting thing. Out of nothing, really, he created something. And it's almost like magic. All right. So you talked about Christopher Columbus. You've got to address this idea of Christopher Columbus not being Italian, because that was totally new for me. But this idea that somehow Christopher Columbus was what we think of as Christopher Columbus was actually representative of somebody else. Can you explain that?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, I mainly got this from a book by Manly P. Hall, who's dead now, but he used to be one of the best Freemason experts in the world. And I don't remember where he got this exactly, but some historical source. He said that Christopher Columbus was actually Greek, left for his voyage to America from a Greek island. And he also said that he was a member of a secret society, and that it was the secret society that gave him the job of coming over here, that they already knew about the United States, or they already knew about America from previous voyages. It was implied that maybe it was the Knights Templar who had come over here previously, and Christopher Columbus was a member of this group called the Knights of Christ, which was sort of a Knights Templar offshoot group. And so Manly P. Hall was basically saying that the Knights Templar and then later the Knights of Christ knew about this landmass, America, and they had this long-term plan of colonizing it and creating this ideal philosophic empire over here. And so before they could do that, they had to have someone formally discover America so that they could, you know, embark upon their projects openly. And so they hired Columbus to do this and gave him existing maps that they already had to make his voyage.
But even the name Columbus is perhaps related more to the word dove.
Oh, yes, yes. Okay.
This is so interesting because I never knew this, but Columbus and Columba, where we also get Columbia, District of Columbia, having to do with the dove of peace or a dove of exploration, if you will.
Yeah. Let me try to remember this. It's
Well, you just wrote the book.
I know. Hold on.
All right, okay. Go ahead. I can probably help you a little bit if you need help on that.
Well, Columba does mean dove, and there was this story, this Greek myth about
the pillars of Hercules, or
it wasn't the pillars of Hercules. Anyway, basically, there was these two rocks that were they were in the ocean, constantly crashing together, and there was this ship that wanted to get through that opening, and you know, you have to wait for the exact moment in time when you can safely get through the rocks, or else your ship gets crushed. And so they sent a dove ahead to see if he could go through safely. And when the dove went through safely, then they knew that they could get their ship through also. And you know, that's kind of similar to the idea of Noah on the ark letting a bird go forth to you know, test and see if there was dry land yet. So, yeah, just the idea of a bird that kind of goes forth and surveys for you to see if the coast is clear.
Well, and I could read a little bit here of your book and just to kind of remind you of what you wrote, because I thought it was fascinating, so I dog-eared it. Now, is there possibly a link between Columbia, Columbus, and Columba the dove? Well, the word Columbus is simply a masculine form of Columba and thus means a male dove. Could the explorer have been given this name, this, because he was sent out by the king and queen of Spain to explore beyond the pillars of Hercules in search of a new passage to India, just as the dove Columba was sent ahead of the Argo to seek passage through the, and then you'll have to pronounce that, I think it's Symplegades. And so many authors have suggested that Christopher Columbus was working under the influence of a secret society of Neo-Templars or Proto-Masons, and that somehow his expedition was through these pillars, was to go to be the explorative dove going through the pillars to find out whether there was safety on the other side or what value or treasure was waiting on the other side. I think that's a fascinating idea, and that'll bring us back to why I was asking people to have a piece of paper and something to write with coming up. Because that you'll have to walk us through the symbol of the dollar and what that represents, if you need to go and check on that coming up here at the top of the hour. So we have Columbus discovering, so to speak, America. You have capitalism developing, which attempts to take nothing and turn it into something from which everybody can benefit. You've got this belief in magic and amulets and the power of a face and the need to trust, just like in stage magic, where you need to believe in something in order for it to work. And this is all coming together for a discussion about symbols in occultism. How many occultic symbols do you believe are on the dollar bill?
I think you have to take the whole thing together, and when you do, everything is an occult symbol because everything relates to something else. It all works together to make a statement.
Okay, so it's sort of the sum of the parts,
exactly,
as well as the parts themselves.
Yes.
All right, so we'll ask people, pull out a dollar. I know that they've done this before, and many people are already familiar with this on Coast to Coast, so this may just be a refresher course for some people, but we'll walk you through the occult symbols, the symbols of masonry, of Freemasonry, and in some cases, the symbols of the Knights Templar that exist on the dollar bill. And then we'll talk about some of the other symbols with which you may not be familiar, which may or may not be true, but will be fascinating to explore. Coming up next with Tracy Twyman, Solomon's Treasure, The Magic and Mystery of America's Money, next on Coast to Coast AM.